Jason, Glenn asked me to do the roll call. She will be joining the call late. So.
Yes, yes, you mentioned it. Thank you.
The recordings have been started.
Thank you. This is Greg Aaron, and this is the Registration Abuse Policy Working Group meeting for November 30th. And, Marika, if you would be so kind as to do the roll call.
Yes, thank you. On the call today, we have Barry Kopp, Mikey O'Connor, Greg Aaron, Faisal Shaw, Rod Rasmussen, James Bledel, and for staff, we have Margie Milam and myself, Marika Koning.
Okay, it looks like everybody's in Adobe except for Rod, where it's early on the West Coast. So we're going to.
I should be on there shortly, there, Greg.
Okay, thanks. We're going to go through the proposed abuse topics and try to knock off as many as possible today, and then we'll circle back to ongoing work. The first one on the agenda is traffic diversion, and what we had on our sheet was traffic diversion, which is the use of brands, invisible text, hidden text, meta tags, and title to manipulate search engine rankings and divert traffic. So that's the name of someone else's brand, perhaps, in meta tags on a website or in hidden text in websites or emails, etc. Does this even have anything to do with domain names, you know, then? James?
Mikey beat me to the punch by a couple minutes, so I'll defer.
Okay. Go ahead, Mikey.
I was just going to be the one to say this, A, doesn't have a whole lot to do necessarily with domain names, and B, doesn't have much to do with registration. It's more of a use. So I would be lobbying, dropping this one.
James?
Yeah, very much the same comment, that while these may be terrible issues, that certainly no one can support these types of behaviors. They are beyond the scope of what we're trying to look at, which is a registration thing. They get very, very close to content and design issues for my taste.
Yeah, I would agree personally, and it seems more like an intellectual property dispute between two parties, and it wouldn't even be covered under UDRP if the brand name was not in the domain name itself being used. So unless anyone has any objection, I think we could strike this one.
Greg, I can't get on the Adobe here. I was just going to say that the one place this would cross over is when somebody registers a domain name, and that would make it a cyber spotting issue anyway. So this would be, I think, a subset of one of the types of things you can do as a cyber spotter, but I don't know that it's, because I'm pretty sure that's why it was in here from my recollection. So, but from that perspective, I think it's already covered in some of the other work we're doing.
Right. Okay. All right, well, we basically strike that one then, sounds like. The next one is offensive site. A website containing adult and or pornographic content using trademark within the domain. And Mikey is first.
I just love these. I feel the same way about this one that I did about the last one. And I liked James's addition of the appropriate disclaimer. Perhaps we don't approve of it, but it doesn't have anything to do with our charter. So I would lobby to drop this one, too.
Okay. And James?
Same statement as before, but I did want to possibly point out that if the distinctive mark is contained within the string of the domain name, and we're talking about in the second level, so it's not a host or a part of the directory structure, then that possibly is a fair target for things like UDRP and anti-cyber squatting mechanisms.
By the way, I see...
Whether that points to offensive material or whether it points to a blank page, I think, you know, all of those apply.
By the way, in Adobe Connect, I see two Faisal Shahs. Faisal, are you logged in twice?
I think I might be. I got booted and I couldn't get back on, so I logged in again.
Okay. All right. Anyway, you have your hand raised. Why don't you go ahead?
I guess I was going to say the same thing that James said. I guess if you registered the name and it's a pornographic term next to the actual domain name along with the domain name, and that could be a potential problem, right? It's kind of along with James' term.
Okay. Yeah. And my personal note is this is a content issue, so I think that's out of our scope. So are we agreed we can move on from this one?
Well, I don't know if we could. I mean, I guess my concern is that if there is, and I guess I would want to discuss this if you guys don't think it's a problem, it's not a problem, but if there is a pornographic term along with the domain name at the time of registration, is that registration abuse?
Or is it cyber squatting? Mikey?
This is Mikey. I'd call that cyber squatting. I am very uncomfortable with offensive content, which is what this is talking about as part of our scope. I think it's wildly out of scope. If there's something in a domain name and the activity happens at registration time, I'm happy to consider that. But I don't think that this describes that situation.
But isn't that what's happening? So if you have, excuse the expletive, but if it says fuck Microsoft, isn't that a problem?
Well, what's really the issue? The brand name is in the domain name, and the brand name is being misappropriated.
Yeah, I'm just throwing it out. I mean, I'm just saying that you're actually taking you actually use that pornographic name at the time, and you are bringing that alongside a distinctive name like Yahoo, Microsoft, whomever, at the time of registration. I guess it does have some, I guess to some extent it has an overlap on cyber squatting, but my question is it this different, or are we looking at it the same way? Because there is content that would come in later on as well, which I think that may not apply, but at the time of registration you have an expletive along with the name of a company, you know, which is Wong.
Okay. I forget exactly who raised their hand in what order, so I'm going to go with Rod first, and then James, and then Mikey.
I just wanted to check, because I'm having problems pulling up stuff here. Is there an abuse topic that talks about pornography and child pornography without the use of domain name in this area that we have to explore?
I think this is it.
Without the use of a brand name. The only reason I bring that up is that you do have some serial offenders that, you know, set up things with, you know, Fastlux networks, all that kind of good stuff. It's other abusive use stuff. It kind of falls into the same category of other things we've already discussed, where you have, you know, somebody who's continually registering domain names in order to put up there whatever it is. Name your poison, and then you have people complaining about it, and it gets taken down, maybe or maybe not. So that kind of fits under this whole category of things that are generally used, but with serial offenders, you may set up patterns or things like that where you can detect it at registration time. So just wanted to point that out, and just there's a whole host of use issues that can be seen at registration time, so that we might want to have that. We had that discussion last week. We might want to lump other stuff into that category as well, as long as we're categorizing abuse types.
Okay. I guess James is next.
Hi, did you say James?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Greg. Just going back to some of Faisal's comments a moment ago, and I'm thinking about how we have to be very careful when we start to feel like we're maybe at the intersection of brand protection versus free speech. And I think that there's some, you know, this is here, there be dragons kind of dangerous territory we start to wander into. For example, I think, you know, without getting too specific, there's an organization that, you know, to its supporters, it is a church, and to its detractors, and I think some jurisdictions in Europe, it is a cult. And one of the ways that they very actively squelch discussion on the Internet is by exercising their copyright and intellectual property rights over its name, its materials, and its doctrines and things like that. So I think that there's, you know, there's a lot of areas here where it just gets a little dangerous when we say, and I think that's the next topic on our list here, Greg, is the gripe site, and I think we see a lot of overlap between that and the use of a brand name in a an offensive or critical site. And once again, I think I go back to, you know, I think the holder of that mark should file a UDRP and, you know, force the respondent to demonstrate that they have failed all of those tests that are laid out in that policy.
Okay, thank you. Mikey?
I think James and I are singing off the same hymnal today. I'm very concerned about the freedom of speech issue here, and we don't really have anybody on the call to advocate that position well, so I'll try to. I like Rod's idea of perhaps lumping some form of this into the serial offenders category that we talked about last time, but I would be very uncomfortable getting into the policing of those kinds of sites, especially gripe sites, through domain name policy.
Yeah. Okay, before we go back to Faisal, I'm going to weigh in with my personal view that this is a cyber squatting issue. This is basically a use of a trademark within a domain. That seems to me to be a dispute between the registrant and the trademark owner. And UDRP has always been used to arbitrate those kinds of disputes. I also think that folks are very correct to say that there are a lot of speech and individual cases that require a close look, and that's what the UDRP does or is for. And to delve into the issues of the case, each individual case itself. So, my view. Back to you, Faisal. Faisal? If you're speaking, you're on mute.
About that. I can understand to some extent gripe sites and whatnot, but is the next thing we're talking about, but I think to some extent, I think there is a, you know, there is, and I think Rod pointed to it, you know, child pornography, but, you know, when it comes to actual pornography and certain uses of words along with names and brand distinctive names, you know, good famous names that are tarnished at registration by names, even what I would consider to be offensive names, then I think there is a registration abuse at that point. And it's a little, I think to some extent, a little different than a gripe site just complaining about something, you know, some sucks name or whatnot. But there has to be a distinction between, one that is targeted towards, you know, to some extent, child porn or whatever else, and the name, and a gripe site.
Well, we're not talking about child porn here, are we? I mean, we could, talk about it, but child porn is one of those few things that's actually patently illegal and reviled around the world. This is adult or pornographic content, perhaps, which is not illegal, at least in most places. So why isn't this cyber squatting? This is misuse of a trademark at registration. And why shouldn't it be solved through a trademark-oriented process?
Well, I think to some extent, I think there is an intersection with the cyber squatting, but I think this may take on, this in this regard, something which has an offensive name, I think, to me, takes on a different role. And I guess that's why this is happening at the time of registration. It's an offensive name. It's an expletive. It's designed for one purpose. And to some extent, there could be all kinds of different types of porn on it. Or maybe we're not tackling child porn at this time. But I don't know. I mean, to me, it just seems like this falls in a different category that needs to be addressed. But I can also see the intersection with cyber squatting. But I think it may be a little different.
James, and then Mikey.
Yeah, so Mikey, I think. Go ahead.
I think Mikey had his hand raised first. I'm sorry, I stepped on you there, James.
Go for it, Mikey.
No worries, this is Mikey. I think that there are several issues. One is porn and offensive speech is a very difficult topic to legislate, even outside of the domain name space. There are different standards in different parts of the world. There are all kinds of very murky legal questions there, whereas the cyber-squatting side of that name, presumably the name would have two components. It would have the offensive word with murky law around it at best, and it would have the brand around which there's much clearer law. And so from just a simple standpoint of addressing the problem, I'm with Greg and the others on this. I think that UDRP and cyber squatting is a much more robust way to fix this problem rather than trying to imbue policy around offensive, which I think, again, the ghost of Wendy Seltzer speaks in my ear. I think that would be very difficult to do, and I'd be really uncomfortable trying to do it.
James?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out when we're discussing the overlap between this issue and cyber squatting, I think that it is almost a total overlap. If you consider that hosting any type of adult content is done for profit or for other type of gain or even to disparage the reputation of a particular brand holder, I think that still falls under the bad faith use of a mark that doesn't that one does not have rights to use. And I think that, you know, if you look at that definition of cyber squatting and then the most general terms, it does pick up this this incident, this type of incident.
I was going to say, I think this is one of the reasons why the bad faith language in the UDRP is very useful and is often applied. Because people who are registering these kinds of names are doing it specifically in bad faith. I'm not aware of a lot of people getting away with this kind of stuff either once they are challenged under UDRP either. So, where are we? Do we really need to try to a further effort to break this out and make it special or in some way? or is it a cyber squatting issue? What's our level of consensus here? Faisal, do you want to? I mean, do you feel that it needs to be called out and requires special treatment somehow?
I think we could probably. I'm just a little. Something about it that really strikes me as being an issue, especially when you take an expletive and you put it right in front of a distinctive name, that I think it just strikes me as not being apart from being a gripe site, not being right. Whether it should be separated or not, I think, I don't know, I'll leave it up to the group. I mean, it could fall within the cyber squatting, and we could try to address it there. But I don't know. I mean, I would like to hear from some other, even from some brand guys that could tell me that they see that as not being a problem, and maybe we could push us off to next week or something until I can get some of these other guys on the call to talk about it.
James, I see your hand up.
Hi, sorry, I was a little slow on the mute button. And just a question for Faisal. And just to be clear, it's not that I don't think this is a problem. It's just that I think that, the intersection with cyber squatting issue is almost complete. And my question would be, can you envision any adjustment or tuning of the cyber squatting definition so that it picks up this type of occurrence?
Yeah, it might be that, we talked about this, in emails this week, and maybe that, I think it might be that if you change the definition of UDRP, again, we're going back, this is what we're talking about, where it's not actually being used, but it actually picks it up with a distinctive name and has that attached to it, it might actually pick it up in EDRP. Does that make sense? Well, it's not actually being used, but it's being registered that way. Which we flip back again, James, as we discussed in the email, back to that ACTA definition, which we keep going back and forth on. It might very well pick up something like this.
Well, one of the things that people have noted about the EDRP is that the language requires use of the domain name. However, for many years, the panels have been coming out with decisions regarding domain names that had never been used. Basically, use was kind of a, in the case log, use has kind of fallen by the wayside. It's not really required. I think that's one of the questions that needs to come up in relation to UDRP. We've been talking about making a recommendation that UDRP, it's time to have a review of it. And I think that's one of the things that needs to be mentioned in our report. Use is in the language, but it's honored only in the breach sometimes.
Well, the ACPA doesn't include the use language, right? I think that's what when Mike wrote about originally had tried to combine both ACPA and UDRP. I think that's what he was getting at. And, when we talk a little bit about some of the stuff that, James and I have talked about in our group here, I think one of the problems with UDRP is you have to have the registration and you have to have the use. They both have to occur. On the ACPA, you only have to have the registration. So I think that to some extent, that's where, it's like you're saying, Greg, maybe they just come up with that outside of UDRP's actual policies, but that should probably come back in, and maybe it will pick up something like this.
Well, I'm reluctant to go back and look at the ACPA stuff again because we said we wouldn't. But
I'm not actually advocating looking at it. In fact, we are. I think it's something that you would actually put in any report that we do in connection with the PDP, and that's where we would put it. But we wouldn't change the definition at this time because I think it would be crazy to kind of try to go back again and revisit it. I'm just pointing out that I could see where that was an issue, and that's an issue that we have discussed before, and you see, it has come up again. And maybe the way to deal with this is in the PDP, right, where you actually put it all in there and say, you know, in, or the issue report, here are all the issues, here's what we think, and here's some of the concerns that have come up, and let's figure it out in the PUP.
Yeah, I would definitely mention this use issue as something that's, you know, one of the reasons why it's time to look at UDRP again. Because it's, like I said, honored in the breach. So, I mean, I would definitely be in favor of that. Does that sound okay
to everybody?
I'm not hearing any demurs. Mikey?
I'm fine with the use issue. I am not comfortable with legislating what constitutes offensive. So if we're still on the offensive side of things, I'm not comfortable putting that in the report. I'm fine with the use registration kinds of stuff, but not at all with I can't get into the job of determining what is offensive.
I personally agree. Listen, we basically have four folks, I think, who have come down as saying this is a cyber squatting issue. Faisal, you want to? I mean, where are you right now? Do you want to bring the use issue in and make sure that's in the report, or is there something else about this that you still feel needs further examination?
Well, I mean, I think we could bring the use report up in the use of issue up in the report, but I just wanted to re-examine it to some extent, and maybe we'd have to bring it up in the use report if it turns that way. But I mean, you just got me on this call right now, and I don't have. I'd like to hear from somebody who's dealing with these particular issues, and especially somebody from a company that has to deal with this. I might even call up Russ from Microsoft and ask him what his thoughts are, so I can actually better prepare for this discussion. But I don't know. It's up to you guys.
Well, it's not up to us. It's up to all of us. I mean, at this point, feel free to bring in some other opinion, but I think the question in front of us is why you have to tell us why this isn't a straight cyber squatting issue. Okay? That's what I think. I mean, that's personally what I want to hear.
Yep. No,
okay. If you want to bring something in next week, please do so.
Okay.
Let's move on to gripe site. Now, let me scroll down here. We grouped these together. Gripe site was deleted for some reason, but it said complaint/forum site with trademark in the domain name, and the classic example was something or other sucks.com, whatever. Why isn't this a cyber squatting issue, or is it? Mikey?
I think there's case law that addresses gripe sites and says that that's an appropriate form of speech, and that in those cases, you lawyer types are going to be a lot better at answering this than I am. But I think there's lots and lots of case law that supports the right to speak out against a brand. Trying to squelch that speech through ICANN, which I don't think is an appropriate role for us.
James?
Yeah, thanks, Greg. This is James, and I think this is an interesting topic because I believe that it touches on the free speech use, but also opens up something interesting, and I'm not a lawyer, so I would defer to the attorneys on the group, but it also opens up the interesting discussion of whether or not anything that's published on a gripe site, if it's known to be untrue, could be
could constitute libel? And if not, does that mean that a printed newspaper is held to a different standard than its online channel, which may, you know, host similar or dissimilar content and having different standards for those different media? So, but having said that, putting all of this under an umbrella and saying that this is probably an area that ICANN shouldn't be treading into. This is very much centered on use and intent and content and all of the things that I think make me very nervous when we start talking about ICANN policy.
I raised my own hand. This is Greg. So I'll basically second everything you say. In the gripe sites I've read about over the years, as Mikey says, there's kind of some case law that's a speech issue. I feel nervous about getting into speech issues and legislating those that I can. It's a usage issue, I think. And also, when somebody really does have a dispute about one of those, sometimes it's about, well, is it really being used for a gripe site or not? You know, are you actually using it for speech, or are you just ripping off somebody's trademark? I think those have to be looked at on an individual basis, and that is what the court system and or UDRP is for, looking at those individual cases when needed. Barry?
Thanks, Ravens. Barry, I just wanted to ask real quick, so in regards to this abuse type, or what we're labeling it as, is there cases in UDRP for both where some have actually were able to reclaim the domain name and others where they didn't put a case through to recover the name as well? Or has this all strictly been in actual true legal courts?
No, there have been UDRP cases about those kinds of sites. I don't know offhand how they've fallen out on which sides.
Okay, thank you.
So, is anybody interested in pursuing this one, or should we? Is it a cyber squatting issue?
Greg, I was just going to point out there's actually a pretty notorious case recently in this area where the actual domain name, and this one I just read about, wasn't a brand. It was talking about Glenn Beck, who I guess could be considered a brand, but. It was a free speech issue, but the way that the domain name was registered made it very interesting. And that they said, in the registration of the domain name, as Glenn Beck, and then did something really evil, or you know, I don't remember exactly what it was. So it made it a very interesting case. And the person who actually registered was able to retain the rights, but it brings up the idea of I can say something in the 63 characters of a domain name, kind of like a tweet, that would be, you know, extremely. You could be very pejorative within that very quickly and get into libel issue, and then the venue, if it's like the UK, could be very important. Bring that up as for full coverage. I'm still kind of in it's more in the cyber squatting arena, but I just bring it up for kind of where this might go as far as what somebody might have in mind here.
No, and in my book, libel is not something for ICANN to make decisions about. It's a court thing. James?
Yes, Greg, you're absolutely right. It's especially ICANN probably is not going to do a very good job in accounting for regional and jurisdictional differences between that definition. I just wanted to point out to Rob, that was a really interesting case because in that particular instance, I believe that the person was claiming that it was a satire site, which I think has some bearing on whether or not something fits the definition of libel. This is my layman's take on that particular case. So, but yes, I agree. It was a very interesting example.
Yeah, that was my take too.
Yeah.
Okay. So where do we stand on this one? Is it? I'd like everyone to voice their opinion. Is it really a kind of a cyber squatting issue and or something that ICANN can stay out of? Or do we need further examination? Mikey?
I'm in the cyber squatting camp.
Okay. Barry?
Likewise, cyber squat.
Faisal?
You're talking about, we were on grab site still, right?
gripes, yeah.
Yeah. I think to some extent, I would say gripe site, if it's not, I'm going to go back to the pornographic issue. If it's just a pure gripe site complaining about a particular company or whatnot, I think it's probably free speech and you can pull it under Cyber Squad.
Okay, thank you. James?
Cyber Squad, if anywhere.
Okay, and I say the same, cyber squatting, if anywhere. So it sounds like we can move on from that one. Okay, next one is fake renewal notices. Let me find that one. Fake renewal notices. And the definition that we had from a while back was correspondence sent to registrants from fake registrar in order to claim renewal fees. First of all, how many of us have actually received one of these in the mail or via email? I know I have.
Yeah, me too, Mikey.
I have dozens every week.
James says yes. The ones I've always gotten were from what appeared to be a reseller, or what was probably a reseller. It wasn't a registrar I had ever heard of. Have you seen anything different, or was it from a totally fake company that had nothing to do with registrations?
This is Mikey. I get them from all sorts of places, but I've never, like you said, Greg, I've never gotten one from a registrar that I had ever heard of before. It may be that they were a registrar, but never anything that I'd heard of.
Hey, Greg, this is James.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the best you can hope for in that situation is that it's a reseller or a registrar that's only going to gouge you on the registration prices. I mean, I think that it's also very likely that they're not related to a registrar or a reseller at all, and they're just looking for someone to cough up the auth ID so that they can transfer your name to some offshore registrar and you'll never see it again.
Yeah. Here, maybe we should break it down. Let me attempt to do so. It wouldn't be unusual for a company to try to get another company's customers, right? You know, all kinds of companies do that. You know, you get mail from one phone company who wants to, you to go to their service from your current one, for example. I'm assuming there's no problem with those. If a registrar wants to solicit your business and they're doing so in a legitimate fashion, you know, using some sort of a mailing list or what have you, I mean, I don't see any issue with that. I think the issue here is the fraudulent nature of these solicitations. There have been some cases internationally, like in Australia and New Zealand a couple of years ago, there was a big case where one of those governments got involved to shut down a registrar that was, a reseller of some company that was trying to, basically steal customers and misrepresenting themselves. So I've seen that happen.
Greg, the case law in the U.S., or case law, or the major one in the U.S. would be the Domain Registry of America. The FTC actually had an injunction against them, I think based on actions from register.com, if I remember at the time. They continued to send out very dubious renewal notices, but they have complied with the letter of the actual injunction the FTC got against them. So I would call them deceptive myself personally, but I guess the courts haven't weighed in on whether or not that would be still deceptive legally or not. Mm-hmm. That's the big one still in the U.S., them and their various affiliates. So I think that might be one of the main drivers of this.
Now, Domain Registry of America was a reseller of another registrar. Is that correct?
I believe they were originally, but I also believe they became accredited at one time, but I don't know that for a fact.
Okay. So in this case, it's an issue of a registrar or reseller sending out renewal notices. Maybe it's not clear to the recipients that this involves a transfer sponsorship.
Correct.
So what's the issue for ICANN?
It seemed to be a transfer policy issue to me, not a registration policy issue.
Well, a transfer issue is covered, perhaps, under our registration definition. Registration being those things that registrars and registries aren't involved in those basic transactions. You know, like we have some PDPs right now in transfers about how they, you know, if registrars want to dispute them, for example, that's been an issue. So a transfer issue could possibly be within scope. James?
Yeah, hi. This is James. And I think that this is one of those things that's hard to categorize. I agree with you, Greg, that it's a transfer issue. If the sender of these fake renewal notices is in fact a registrar or a reseller, then it can become a transfer issue or means of disputing a transfer. If not, then it becomes sort of somewhat of a domain hijacking type of an issue. And I also see the potential for a who is abuse issue. I hate to take us down that rabbit hole, but clearly they received the contact information from the registrants through questionable means. You know, if I have a name with GoDaddy and GoDaddy says I don't sell, you know, information about my customers, and yet somebody got it somehow, then I think that that's another area that this potentially touches on.
Mm-hmm. Now, what you're saying is basically somebody mined the Whois data, right?
I think that's my strong suspicion that that's the origin of a lot of these fake renewal notices.
Yeah. Now, registrars, in the current contract, there's a prohibition against registrars using Whois data in that fashion, I think. For marketing purposes, I'd have to go look.
Yeah, I'd have to take a look.
I think that's probably true under the old and the new. All right, I'm going to find it here. Well, would anyone else like to weigh in?
This is Mikey. I think that one of the questions that I hear you trying to get at, Greg, is to what extent ICANN even has jurisdiction. If these folks aren't bound by any of our contracts, they're not registrars, they're not registries, they're essentially fraudulent actors out there in the world. I'm not much as I would like to swat this behavior, I'm not sure that we've got any jurisdiction.
If it's a reseller, is the reseller bound to the same terms and conditions that its parent registrar is?
This is my
was that a question or a statement?
That's a question. That's a question.
Okay. Because it certainly is.
Yeah, I was going to say the same.
I mean, contractually, I believe they are. And there's also been some discussion of this recently because various parties have weighed in and said, look, resellers need to be held to the same requirements. I think there's total consensus on that. I'm just wondering, is it totally clear in the contracts and so forth?
I guess my question is, are most of these fraudulent letters coming from resellers, or are they coming from somebody who's not a reseller? That That's where I was headed. To the extent that these letters are coming from registrars or resellers, then I think we do have jurisdiction. And I would feel quite comfortable including a discussion of this in the PDP, because registrants, especially unsophisticated registrants, are being defrauded by this behavior. And to the extent that I can help mitigate that, I think it would be a great thing.
Okay. Mikey, you bring up the jurisdictional issue. If it's a reseller doing it, then I would hope that reseller is bound to the terms and conditions that its parent registrar is. The question then becomes, what happens? So what? If it's not a registrar or reseller and it's just a fraud, or a scam of some sort, then what's YCAN's role?
So this is Rod. I think that there's two parts in that fraudulent side. One is the fraudster is trying to get your credit card or what have you. I don't think ICANN has any role in there, because a fraudster can try and get your credit card in about a million ways. It just happens to be using a domain name in this particular case. In the case of a hijacking, I think there's a role in the remediation of a hijacking type event. But I don't know that, you know, the ruse that is used to do a hijacking really matters as much as just the fact that the domain was hijacked at all. And I don't know that whether that comes really under the scope of this group.
Yeah. And does a hijacking involve, I mean, we're talking about changing the Whois data or just the transfer between registrars?
I
ask because if there's a dispute about a transfer, there is a transfer dispute policy where a registrar can raise the red flag and the problem can be worked out. There's an existing process for that.
This is Mikey. We're also working on that in the post-expiration domain name recovery working group for pure hijackings staying within a registrar. But I think that in answer to your earlier question, Greg, what happens if the registrar, if this is being done by a registrar or a reseller, then I think ICANN does have a role. They can do enforcement actions, but there may not be rules by which enforcements can be brought right now. And if that's the case, then I think this is a problem.
Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Just to correct what Mikey said, he said post-expiration domain name recovery working group, but I think he meant to say the IRTP working group. They have as one of their issues to look at whether a process for urgent return of hijacking domain names should be developed.
Okay. Thank you. So it sounds like we boiled it down to if a registrar or reseller is involved in this kind of misleading activity, what's the recourse? Or what should ICANN do? That's the way to phrase it. Does that sound logical, James?
Yeah, I think I'm just going to go ahead and play devil's advocate here for a little bit. I think what we would need to understand is if it is truly coming from a registrar or a reseller, and we need to define what the deception is. You know, is it the deception that they are purporting to be your current registrar and giving you a renewal notice versus, you know, offering you some sort of a special deal or promotion to transfer? You know, I mean, if I were to take Mikey out to lunch and say, hey, Mikey, you know, GoDaddy would give you this really great coupon if you move your names to our services. I want to make sure that just genuine outreach or attempts to be competitive on price and service are not caught up by anything we would try to do here.
And so I think to avoid that, we would need to define what is the deceptive action here. Is it purporting to be the current registrar? Is it purporting to be a registrar when they're not? Or you know, what lie are they telling?
I think you've hit on something important. Again, the problem here is fake, deception or fraud, not legitimate competition or so on. Mikey?
Yeah, actually, I got so wrapped up in this part of the conversation, I forgot what I was going to say, so I'm going to drop off. I agree with James that you know, we certainly don't want to accidentally derail normal competition. And as you start to define fake, then you start to get into all that difficulty that you run into whenever you... It's almost the same kind of difficulty that you run into the speech area. And so it does, the devil's in the details on this one, that's for sure.
Okay. Well, what's the best way to proceed on this one? There's this issue of basically, is a registrar or reseller doing something that is deceptive or fraudulent? And do those situations lead to, what's the harm? If there's a transfer dispute, it can be disputed. There's a process for that, but I mean, in general, it's not something we like to see in the industry. James?
Yeah, if I can maybe skip ahead to crafting some recommendation or disposition on this particular issue, would be that really this is this one umbrella fake renewal notice touches on several things. If it is a registrar or reseller of an accredited registrar, then you know, we get, then it becomes somewhat of a transfer issue. It becomes somewhat of a who is use issue, and it possibly could even translate into some beefier language under that section that we quoted in the RAA. If it's not a registrar or reseller and it's simply an attempt to hijack, then I think that we need to categorize it as you know, some sort of a hijacking attempt, and then again, it probably falls under IRTP as opposed to registration abuse. And again, I think that last point there about trying to define and put some boundaries around what the deception is when these things are going out, I think is also important. So I think bottom line for me anyway is that this is probably not... something that can be addressed by registration abuse policies, but definitely should be referenced or referred to other working groups who are working on this area. So that's IRTP, that's the you know, any of the future who is or who is misuse groups, and I think Mikey also touched on PEDNR as well. That might be a possibility, depending on when these renewal notices are actually received. So, I mean, just cutting to the chase, that's kind of my my feeling in the abstract.
This is Mikey, and a question for Margie. And that is, from the kind of enforcement side of ICANN, does ICANN feel like they need more tools in this area, or is the sense that the tool set that exists today is sufficient to address this kind of stuff?
Sure. In our RAA working group, we have made some recommendations for additional enforcement tools, but I don't know that they're specific to this particular issue. It's broader violations of the RAA, and I'm not sure that there's a very specific requirement related to the issue that we're talking about.
It seems like that would maybe be another, this is Mikey again, sorry, another of the catalog of recommended destinations for this issue that maybe the RAA working group take a look at.
I'm wondering if Mikey and James would be able to craft a paragraph just kind of explaining what the issue is. We kind of narrowed it down to this is an issue of registrars or resellers doing something which might be fraudulent or deceptive, and maybe making a recommendation to us about how to refer that to another conversation, such as, you know, the RAA discussions. Would you like to take a shot at it? Doesn't have to be long.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that.
Okay. Okay, thank you. I'll put that down as an action item. Would you like to move on? Go ahead. Why don't we move on? Who is topics? We've actually got one discussion going on now, which is the who is accessibility issue I raised a couple of weeks ago. And Rod and Mikey have definitely volunteered to help. And what we're thinking about doing is we're going to go visit 50 representative registrars or so and see if they're currently offering access to their WHOIS, for example. So we started drawing up a list, and that's about as far as we've gotten.
I'm just going to chime in that where I've had my detection team or my team that does mitigation work is also cataloging every time we have a registrar that is not publishing WHOIS, so that we can, you know, find out who owns domains. We can contact them to let them know they've been hacked or something like that. So we're keeping track of that as we starting a couple weeks ago.
James?
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt, Greg. I was actually reading the RAA when I caught a little bit of a snippet of what you guys were saying there. Are you saying that you're going out and checking to or auditing to see if registrars are offering WHOIS on their website and via port 43? Because that seems duplicative to some compliance efforts that are currently underway. Maybe you can just piggyback on what they're doing.
Maybe, although I'd like to do some independent verification, independent of what the compliance staff might be doing, just to get an idea of what's up. We do have the option of I can go to David Giza and say, you know, what do you guys have going on?
Oh, this is Mikey. I think it'd be a good idea just to find out. There are enough windmills to tilt at in the world without adding extra ones. If compliance is actually working on this,
yeah, I can do that. I'll put that down as an action item. Okay, I've got that down. Okay. I think that's the only WHOIS thing we have going on. So that'll continue. Next topic is use of stolen or fraudulent credentials. And let's see if we have anything on our sheet. But I do recall that Rod has been interested in this topic.
I'm always interested on that topic.
Yeah. But why don't you go ahead, Rod, because I don't think we have anything on the sheet.
All right. Can we come circle back to this in a couple of minutes? I'm in an inconvenient place to do that right now.
Okay. All right. We'll come back to that. Let's see. Domain tasting is on the list still. And that's, of course, use of the ad grace period to test the marketability of a domain. Now, since we put this on the list, We've seen the results of the new excess delete policy come into effect. And there are some numbers published by the staff that show that the tasting has been virtually eliminated. James?
Yeah, much the same. Just wanted to echo what you were saying or about to say there, Greg, is that this is one of those few areas where I think ICANN can point to and say that they've achieved an unequivocal victory over a problem, and I think that while it should be continued to be monitored in case they find some new way around the existing excess deletions policy, we can call this dragon dead.
Yeah, I think this might be one where there's actually a policy in place now and it seems to be working. Is it, anybody else have any comments? If not, maybe we can move on then to kiting, which, let me find that on the sheet. It's on here. I don't think this one's on the sheet, but it came up at some point.
No, it's on there.
It is on the list. It's under offensive category and just above domain tasting.
It's on page 4, Greg.
Page 4. Oh, okay, domain kiting. I'm sorry. Okay, abuse of the 5-day grace period to register, delete, and immediately re-register a domain. I actually looked at this issue in my own registry once. And I didn't actually see it occurring in .info. And I assume the reason is that it's too difficult to hang on to a domain name for any period of time if there's actually anybody remotely interested in it, because the domain actually becomes free every 4 to 5 days. James?
Yeah, Greg, could you provide a definition when you say you look at this and this being kiting? Can you just tell me maybe for the benefit of the group?
Yeah, kiting basically is you register a domain name, delete it sometime during the grace period. If you delete a domain in the add grace period in the registries, it immediately gets deleted and becomes reavailable in the pool of available names. So if somebody's kiting, they go and they just register it, and then they delete it, then they re-register it over and over again. You're basically getting a free domain name. Now, what I did about a year or so ago was I was curious and just we looked at to see if there are any names that got deleted and re-registered in grace period multiple times, and really didn't find any. My assumption being that, one, if the name's worth anything, somebody else out there in the world is probably interested in it, and there will be contention for the name. Second, domain names at this point are pretty cheap. And why go through the trouble and the risk of losing the domain if you could just pay a few dollars for it? Does that outline it?
Well, thanks. Yeah, that helps. And I think from a definitional purpose, are we talking about the name is being repeatedly deleted and re-registered at the same registrar or different registrars by the same registrant or different registrants? I'm just trying to put some meat around what this term means from an operational standpoint.
I can tell you what I did. I just looked for domains that had been registered and re-registered a lot. I didn't look to, I didn't exclude it if it was different registrars or different registrants. Of course, some names are picked up once or twice after deletion. That's not unusual. But the questions you ask, I don't think we've actually put enough definition around it.
To this is Mikey, just to gently tweak James, I think that Bob Parsons invented this term. Might want to ask him. I really talked to you about it a couple, 3 years ago. And I think that's where it came from. It was on his
I've heard the term used both internally and in the IACN community, and I've just never been able to necessarily make sure that we can paint it into a narrow enough corner that we can actually put it under a microscope and figure out what we can do about it.
Actually, I just looked this up. I'm on the Bob Parsons blog.
Okay.
And what Bob was talking about, what he called domain kiting, would be what I think the community has started calling something else. I mean, he was talking about basically tasting.
Okay.
He was saying, out of 35 million names, 32 million were part of a kiting scheme. But what he was really talking about was domain tasting.
That's so we don't have those kinds of numbers to support kiting?
Well, what he was calling kiting was really what everybody else calls tasting now. And the tasting issue has gone away.
Okay, but I think there is a distinction that he was trying to make, correct? Between tasting and kiting?
No, I don't think so. He was basically saying it's an abuse of the ad drop period.
Okay. Which they both would be.
Right.
He called it
domain kiting takes advantage of timing and the domain name system in an abusive and improper way to generate cash. The people put up many websites loaded with search engine links. And then they keep the ones they want. So that is tasting.
Well, I think the distinction, and I guess where I'm going with this, is the distinction is that tasting would be, you would do this to a large number of names and find out if any of them had any viability and then keep the very, very small percentage that did. That have some viability in a PPC context. And then kiting would then possibly come in after that, where you were saying, now that I have identified the 0.0001% of the names that I've tasted, now I'm going to try and figure out a way to get them for free as opposed to paying $6. So I think that the two are closely related and they compound each other, and I think that we've put a stake through the heart of tasting for the most part, but I'm just trying to put a pretty clear boundary on where one begins and where one ends. That's all.
Yeah. Now, I posted the link to the Bob Parsons blog. Now, Marika has posted a little clip in the chat window about basically criminals getting domain names, and then they use them within the grace period, after which they can be deleted and for a refund. So basically, use of a domain name for free in the ad grace period for some sort of a criminal thing. I personally have seen that done with for spamming. Spammer buys a bunch of domain names, they send out their spam, and then the registrar may delete those. Now, the registrar could be the one getting taken advantage of there as well, because they're stuck with the if a fraudulent credit card was used, then they're stuck with the bill. They can delete the names, but they may get hit by for an excess deletion.
This is Mikey. That's a third definition, because that would be one-time use.
That's right. One-time. Yeah. I see Margie's hand raised.
Yeah, I just wanted to provide my understanding on the difference between domain tasting and domain kiting. Kiting, as I recall, was the practice where it's not that it would be registered and dropped within 5 days, but it would be picked up immediately by the same party or a party affiliated, like an affiliated entity, in order to never let the domain name get into the hands of someone else, and to avoid detection on who was actually the registrant. So I think that was, as I recall, the difference between a hiding in a tasting, as opposed to just having some, you know, names switch hands for 5 days and somebody else would own it. It was having the same party registered over and over again to avoid, you know, detection.
And how would that avoid the fee, Margie?
Well, sometimes the WHOIS records wouldn't be updated in that situation, and it was really meant to own the name without having to pay for it. So, you know, it's the same party doing it over and over again for, you know, consecutive 5-day periods, you could own the name for a month. And so it was just a little bit different than domain tasting, where it could theoretically be random people picking up the name every 5 days.
This is Mikey. It seems to me, looking forward to a PVP, that there is an interesting conversation to be had here on two lines. One, nailing down a definition, because it sounds like there are several. Seems like a useful thing to do. And the second would be to conduct some research sort of along the lines of what you did, Greg, but more broadly, to determine to what extent this is a problem. And I think James added an interesting wrinkle. When a person might move the name around between a group of affiliated folks across various registrars, again, it would be easier to see this. This is back to the conversation we had last week, where this behavior would be easier to see at the registry than it would be at the registrar. And all apologies to James for the little tweak. This is an interesting topic, and I would support recommending that I can take a look at it.
James?
Yeah, I agree, Mikey. And I think part of the point of that exercise and asking some of those questions is that I think that there is a lot of variety in the definition of what hiding means to different individuals and organizations. So I think that before we can say, yes, it belongs here, no, it belongs, no, it doesn't belong here, or it should be referred to some other group or whatever, or point to tasting and say that we fixed it and we fixed hiding too, I don't know that we can have those answers with any degree of confidence until we have a robust definition that we can work with.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like we have at least three different definitions. And then the question after that becomes, do we have any data? Which we might not. Now, does anybody want to take a crack at definitions?
Hey, Greg, this is Rod. I don't want to take a crack at definitions, but what I'd like to do is suggest that we check with the working groups that already worked on this stuff in the domain. There was a tasting group within ICANN, if I remember correctly, and I believe that there's been follow-on studies at least to look at what the levels are. I think they may well have definitions and data already in play, and we could probably answer this question if we just get the information from those groups.
Okay, well, the tasting group's report would be out there, because they shut down a while back. Their report would contain anything of interest, I think. And then the only let me ask our staff members. There was something published by the staff in the spring, is my recollection, about the tasting levels. Has there been any further study or statistics since then?
This is Marika. I think another report is supposed to come out relatively soon. But again, I think that focuses specifically on domain tasting. I think Mike Rodenbach was closely involved in the domain tasting working group, so he might be the person to ask whether they looked at kiting and have some further information. I'm happy to check with him and also to see if any other ICANN staff might be aware of any information on this issue, if you like.
That would be wonderful if you could make the inquiries. May I put you down for that action item?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay, super. Thank you for volunteering. Okay, well, we'll circle back to that one then as we get more info. Now, Rod, are you back with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so let's circle back to use of stolen or fraudulent credentials. I recall that you had some interest in this topic.
Well, sure, because I mean that's how most criminals get a hold of domain names to use them. In fact, pretty much, I've yet to meet a criminal or find a criminal who puts their own name and uses their own credit card, other than I guess in extremely rare cases to set up a phishing site or something like that. But I think that there'd be a fairly large consensus that this is inappropriate behavior at registration time. The question becomes more operational as to what do you do about it. I think that this area kind of gets into just the general abuse of registration systems, and are there ways that ICANN and the ICANN community can work together either via policy or creating an environment where information can be used between different members of the ICANN registration community on various activities that are going on across the board, not just in from one registrar to internally. I think that's kind of what I was thinking this area could be looking at, is those kinds of mechanisms and those kinds of policies or procedures that would allow better information sharing across the industry to curtail these this central form of abuse.
Okay. Thank you. Mikey has his hand raised.
Yeah, this is Mikey. I am an enthusiastic supporter of pursuing this. I would throw out a couple of legs on the stool. One would be policy. One would be controls. And one would be information sharing as mechanisms to mitigate these risks. And I think all three of those at least go together nicely. To the extent that, in the policy arena, ICANN can make those policies, but in the information sharing and in the control, ICANN can play a leadership role, although they may be inappropriate for ICANN to actually do those things. But I think to the extent that ICANN could convene interested parties, work out formal or informal agreements between them and facilitate the making more difficult for criminals to do this sort of thing, that's all a very good thing. So I'd be...
Rod, this is Greg. May I ask a question? Why...
Yes, so can you ask another?
Why... it seems very easy for criminals to get away with it, because it happens every day. And I guess my question is, why is it so easy, and why aren't significant numbers of these caught during the credit card validation process?
Well, I would say that actually it depends on the company, whether it's a registrar or a reseller that they're utilizing, and we see evidence of this all the time in our work, and kind of dealing with it after the fact. And we've got a representative, I think one of the better companies at detecting things on the call with James, and that GoDaddy does a rather fabulous job of finding these things ahead of time. Whereas we have a very small reseller that happens to be, I don't know, out of Turkey or something like that, that has got, you know, very, very low amounts of catching these guys, and the bad guys get in and you abuse them quite a bit. And that typically comes back to the amount of credit card validation they're doing, IP geolocation of what people say they are versus where they are actually, and a whole host of other tricks that you can do to find fraudulent transactions. You see the same thing in the merchant world, where you have different merchants that are abused far more heavily than others, and it usually comes down to just the level of fraud prevention and detection that they're doing. One thing I was going to add, I think in the case of the domain registration world, there's some really interesting things you can do because of the data that you're collecting to fill in who is at the same time, where you wouldn't have that necessarily in a merchant world. And they can actually increase your likelihood of catching somebody who really isn't who they say they are when they're registering a domain name.
All right. James, your hand's up.
Yeah. Thanks, Greg. This is James, and we're still discussing fraudulent credentials. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
Okay. You know, there's something to be said. I mean, I think certainly no one wants to see a situation where, registrants or accounts are easily compromised and domains are stolen, moved, or repurposed for abuse. But I think that I have a little bit of a underlying concern about ICANN stepping in and saying that this is grounds for policy development, because I think that what will happen is that ICANN will say this is the type of technology that must be used, or these are the type of procedures that must be followed. And I think that ICANN has a tendency in policy development to be overly prescriptive when I thank Rod for holding us up as a kind of a good example out there in the ecosystem, is that registrars can use this as an area of saying, you know, while all registrars strive for some level of security, our security is better than X. And I think that's a good point of differentiation and a good point of competition, and I would hate for that to be an unintended casualty of any types of good intentions on the part of ICANN in this area.
Mm-hmm. Mikey, go ahead.
This is Mikey. I think that there's room in ICANN policy to do the same sort of thing that we're looking at in some of the other working groups, where we set a floor, but not necessarily a ceiling for these things. And I'm also sort of drawn to the model of the credit card industry security arena, where if you want to play in a certain kind of credit card arena, you need to adhere to a set of physical and operational controls in order to be certified for that. And I think that given the nature of this problem, we might want to get, you know, I'm uncomfortable stepping all the way back and saying let the market prevail here, because I think that Rod's point about the smaller organization in a part of the world that doesn't have the right kind of infrastructure capability, yet that small organization is just as accessible worldwide, presents a problem that I don't know that I have an answer yet, but I think it's certainly worthy of conversation. And there may even be solutions that come out of that for the smaller registrars and resellers that are fairly inexpensive. Subscription services, for example, is the way that the credit card industry has addressed this.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a bunch of interesting models to pursue that I'm not sure we want to pursue them in our conversation, but that would be a good thing to recommend for a subsequent conversation.
This is Greg. I'll add something, then we'll go to James, and then we're going to be at the end of the meeting. To an extent, my impression is that registrars all rely, at least to some extent, upon the credit card processors and gateways that they choose to use, whether that's run by Visa or MasterCard or whoever. And then on top of that, there are other things that the registrar can also do. Some of the cross-referencing, for example, that Rod mentioned, you know, does the IP, you know, match the country that the cardholder is apparently in, those kinds of things. So some of this, I'm asking, is some of this is within the registrar's control. Some of it is without their control because they have to rely on a credit card processor. Some of what you're also talking about is resellers. I know that some reseller systems use a credit card processing gateway provided by the registrar. Other resellers don't. The reseller is responsible for obtaining their own credit card transactional processing through whoever they want to use, I guess. So there's a variety of models, and there's several moving parts, it seems like. James?
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Very briefly, I think that Mikey and Barry and some others and I have talked about this minimum baseline of security requirements that could be included in registrar contracts. And I think I'm, for the most part, not completely opposed to something like that, Mikey, but again, I think that we have to, the frustrating, I think, paradox is that we have to make sure that they're not overly prescriptive and they don't say something like, you will use technology X in process Y or something like that, because for a couple of reasons. One is that it's too limiting for those registrars who already have good systems in place, and two, it's basically providing would-be abusers and criminals with a blueprint on not how to hack one registrar, but how to hack all registrars. So I think that, you know, it's important to set that baseline, keep the language general, and allow, you know, the market players to innovate above that to create diversity and differentiation through all the different providers.
Okay. Mikey, you're going to be last.
I love being last. This is Mikey. That's part of the, James, that's part of the reason that when I kicked off my comments, I said I thought this was probably a three-legged stool. I agree that policy is often a pretty large, blunt instrument at this kind of problem. Sort of drawing on my years as a controller of a Big Ten university. And there are two other legs that I think ICANN could lead in. I think one is this notion of information sharing and facilitating that, and the other is in sort of building the community and focusing on control structures. Controls are a long topic that are way more than the 10 seconds that I want to keep talking, but my main point is that I think that this is worthy of subsequent discussion without trying to find what the outcome of that discussion is.
Okay. All right, well, we're coming up at the end of the meeting. Sounds like we'll need to have some further discussion about this one. So one of the things I see developing is, you know, Rod is pointing out an issue which enables a lot of malicious use. You know, so looking at what the criminals are doing in order to carry out those malicious uses, and one way to strangle that is by paying more attention to the fake credentials and how they get a hold of those dominions in the first place. Something that came up in the discussion was the issue of minimum requirements for registrars. That issue of there always being a weakest link somewhere in the world or in somebody's system, et cetera. So let's come back to that. Just briefly, we had to doodle up for the next meetings, and it looked like there was pretty much universal agreement among those who filled it out that continuing meetings every week at the same Monday time was going to be the best option. So what that means is we would have December meetings on the 7th, 14th, and 21st at least. So those would be our next three meetings. So we'll send out a reminder about that. But if at all possible, please put those on your calendar now. And next meeting, we'll certainly circle back to uniformity of contracts and so forth. Barry, I know I didn't get a chance to go over your document in markup over the holiday. So yeah, I'm gonna plead the turkey. Tryptophan is my excuse, but I owe you those, and let's put that near the top of the agenda for next week, and then we'll pick up these remaining issues, including credit cards and so forth. Does that sound good?
Works for me, Mikey here.
Sounds good.
Okay. Excellent. Yep. All right. Well, I'll send out some notes from today's meeting. We do have a few action items. And please plan on a meeting at the same time next week.
Thanks, Greg.
Good meeting, everybody. Thanks so much for your great discussion. Okay. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.